Fortunately for you, the service wasn't held Friday night. I was not only feeling positive, I was extremely verbal. Finally, Robin decided to go to bed, so she wouldn't have to listen to me anymore. I was talking to my sister, my youngest sister, on Saturday. I talked to her Friday night, and she was telling me, she had talked to one of my other sisters and said, "Yeah, Randy talked to me a long time. He never talks, you know." And you have to understand, my little sister, it's nonstop. You just call her, she calls you, just sit there for a while and listen to her because she just talks all the time. And so evidently she didn't get to talk. She was listening to me talk. And, but she was talking to my one of my sisters Saturday, and my youngest sister had knee surgery about 6 weeks ago, and she was fidgeting around trying to get comfortable and twisted her knee just the wrong way and had a sharp pain, and she wasn't injured, but she was, you know, yelled into the phone and said, "I gotta go, I'm hurt." "Well, I'm not hurt," you know, all this kind of stuff, you know, nothing, no emergency, but I'm in pain, I gotta go. And so she got off the phone, and my nephew walked in, and so she's sitting there crying, and she goes, "Uncle Randy had surgery." And he goes, "Oh no, he died." She said, "No, I hurt my knee, he's fine." And so then his friends walked in, and he was all upset, and he goes, "Well, my mom just hurt her knee, but she's okay, but I thought my uncle died, but he's okay." And then Erica, she has all these, you know, she works and she's doesn't have all the access to messages and stuff at work, and so she had told Robin not to call unless something was wrong, because she wouldn't be able to respond very well. So after surgery, I was feeling great, so I picked up the phone and called Erica and left a message. Well, it was ringing, so she tried to call back, but it was while I was leaving a message, so she couldn't call back, and then she couldn't access her voicemail. And so she went through this about 3 or 4 minute period when she thought, as my nephew, that I was dead too. So so it made for interesting life for other people. Daniel has gone through a period of time that we know nothing about. We leave Daniel, we really don't know all the time periods exactly. Daniel's approximately 16 years old when he goes to Babylon. We know that he's in the King College for 2 to 3 years, and it would appear after that period, toward the end of that period, he has the encounter with the king when the king has a dream. We don't know the exact timing of that. We assume it's after that period. He's been there a few years. But it would appear early in his time there that Daniel interprets the king's dream. There's some period of time, and once again, we don't really know that period of time. We would think it's fairly early that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego refused to bow down to the king, and they had that experience. Then we know, it's some time later. We don't really know what it's in relationship to the king when the king goes through, when Nebuchadnezzar goes through his period of insanity. There's an approximately 10-year period there, 7 years that he's nuts. There's the announcement before that was a year, and then there's possibly, a year or two recovery before he writes his decree, though it maybe happened immediately. But we have this period of time that's stretched out, and we really don't know the chronology when those events occurred in this time period. But Nebuchadnezzar was king for 43 years, and Daniel was under his reign for those 43 years. He went there when he was approximately 16 years old. And so that would put Daniel somewhere around 60 years old when Nebuchadnezzar died. Nebuchadnezzar has been dead for about 23 years when we come into the fifth chapter of Daniel, which is the concluding chapter of Babylon's reign as a kingdom. Daniel would be approximately, in his early 80s at this time. And Nebuchadnezzar, as we looked last week, went through a process, or God went through a process with Nebuchadnezzar, where he was exposed to the revelation of God. that there was a response, there was a recognition of God. There seems to be a progression. With his first dream, he recognized that Daniel was a revealer of mysteries, and that Daniel's God was a revealer of mysteries. That, you know, all the credit, Daniel gave no credit to himself, but it was coming from God. So God is the revealer of mysteries. Daniel's God is. It wasn't a setting aside his gods, but there was an elevation of Daniel's gods. Nebuchadnezzar, through Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, recognized that their God was a deliverer. When he was positive, no God could deliver in the situation they were in. And he saw himself as supreme over gods even, and yet Yahweh delivered. And so he recognized that their God was a deliverer. And then in that second dream, as we looked last week, he recognizes that God is supreme. Now, there's, because of wording and the lack of terms that we would find in New Testament, was Nebuchadnezzar a believer? Could be asked the question to use our terminology. And from the text, perhaps it would be impossible to say with certainty, though the way things are written, it would indicate to me he responded to the message, to the truth he had, that he responded to everything that God provided for him at that point. He's recognizing God as supreme. So I would think that in our terminology, that he would be a believer. He responded to the message of God as it was revealed. And in the kingdom, he elevated Daniel's God. Each step, Daniel's God is elevated to where at the end he's saying, this God, he says, "Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise, exalt, and honor the King of heaven. For all his works are true and his ways just, and he is able to humble those who walk in pride." He's given a testimony. All of chapter 4 is a written testimony by the king to the sovereignty of the Most High God. But then he dies. Another king comes in, his son comes in and reigns for a couple of years, and then a brother-in-law comes in, reigns for a couple of years, and then another king comes in, another son, and he reigns for quite a few years. And during his reign, he kind of comes to a point of probably a semi-retirement or whatever, and he brings in his son as a co-regent. And the father king has possibly retired and moved away, or possibly died, and the son is reigning now, Belshazzar, and that's where we come into this chapter. And it's at the end of the time of Babylon, 20 plus years after Nebuchadnezzar has left the scene. When he left, Babylon was the power, the supreme power in the world as far as a ruling nation. But God had already said that Nebuchadnezzar would reign, and he would have a supreme power, but then there would come another, and it would be weaker, and then another that would be weaker, and we're going to see this step down. And now we move into that. I've titled this chapter 5 as "The God of Life Sends a Message of Doom." It's the God of life, and that's one of the titles we see of God in this passage. The God of life, but yet the message is a message of doom. It starts, and we might summarize this first section as the arrogance is often shown by one's disdain for the supreme God. That's just a general thing. Arrogance is often shown by just a disdain for the supreme God. And you see that everywhere. There's a way of, the whole elevation of man is by a lowering of God. If you have a high view of God, then you cannot have a high view of man or a high view of self. And as you want to elevate your view of yourself, your view of mankind, then God has to be lowered. And that's partly what we see. In the face of great opposition, Babylon, Medo-Persia is attacking Babylon. And they have, the attack has been going on for some time. The city is basically surrounded, but yet Babylon is a mighty city. And they have great supplies, they have a river running through it, and they're fairly content that they're going to be able to outlast this. But in the face of this great opposition, as the war party is outside the walls, Belshazzar sought to show his supremacy by using gold and silver goblets from the temple in Jerusalem to toast his gods of gold, silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Note the repetition as we read these four verses of the vessels from the temple in Jerusalem. Chapter 5, verse 1. Belshazzar, the king, held a great feast for 1,000 of his nobles. He was drinking wine in the presence of the thousands. When Belshazzar tasted the wine, he gave orders to bring the gold and silver vessels which Nebuchadnezzar his father had taken out of the temple, which was in Jerusalem, in order that the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines, might drink from them. Then they brought the gold vessels that had been taken out of the temple, the house of God, which was in Jerusalem, and the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines, drank from them. They drank the wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Why do you do this? This seems to have been not a normal thing to do. The Nebuchadnezzar, when he conquered Jerusalem, he took the vessels from the temple. They were taken not in a sacred trust of Yahweh. They were taken to show supremacy over Jerusalem's gods. But where were they? They seem to have been stored away somewhere, and it wasn't a normal thing to use these. Had perhaps during Nebuchadnezzar's reign, as he recognized Most High God, had he put them back in a more secure place? We really don't have that information, but we can tell from the text this was not normal. This was not what they were used for. And yet, Belshazzar is looking outside the walls, and he's seeing the great opposition against his king, and perhaps in a sense of trying to build up morale, he has this great feast to show how strong and superior they are. And then to even go further, he says, well, let's get those goblets, let's get the vessels from the temple in Jerusalem, and we will toast to, we will drink to our gods of gold and silver by using the gold and silver goblets. But look at all the gods he's drinking to, the gods of gold, the god of silver, the god of elements, wood and stone. It's just these gods. Where is the God that Nebuchadnezzar had come to recognize? In the writing of this, there's a clear repetition. There's not going to let us slip by and fail to recognize these vessels came from the temple in Jerusalem. These vessels came from Yahweh's temple. And we're also seeing here just the arrogance, the disdain that Belshazzar has. Well, second, God's revelation is a discomforting thing to those who dismiss God while elevating self. You know, when you talk about the Bible to somebody, talk about God's revelation, that's just something that you just, people, if they're dismissing God, they dismiss that. If they're into self, they don't want to hear about revelation. Now, people may be into spirituality, but that's quite different from the revelation of God. It's a strange time we live in, and it has been for, in one sense, I guess you could say since, at the fall, it's been a strange time. Every period is a strange time. But when you look at the history of the United States and the embrace of various truth and religion, but yet, in the last 30, 40 years, we went through a period where It's kind of an anti-spiritual period, anti-religion, anti-spiritual. But then all of a sudden, spirituality came back into being, and people wanted to be spiritual. And so it's a positive thing to be spiritual, but it's a totally different thing to talk about revelation, to talk about a supreme God, to talk about directives from a God. Because if there are directives from God, then we're talking about absolutes. If they're directives from God, we're talking about things that are right and wrong. If we're talking about right and wrong, then we're talking about your behavior and some evaluation of it, some judgment of it. And we're not comfortable with that as a nation. So we like things to be spiritual, but when you talk about revelation, that's another issue. And here we see a disdain for that supreme God. In the face of this revelation becomes discomforting. And what we see here is an appearance of the hand caused by the king's, the appearance of a hand on a wall caused the king's face to become pale. He turns white as he sees, and as understandable, a hand. Not a person, just the hand. The back of the hand and the fingers start writing on the wall. And so you can imagine, what would you feel? But maybe you'd feel even more if you're in that setting. The fingers writing out a message alarmed the king. He calls in his messengers or his wise men. Come, interpret this for me. And they're perplexed. The wisest of the wise men are perplexed about this. And the king's face turns even a lighter shade of paleness. Look, we read verses 5 to 9. Suddenly the fingers of a man's hand emerged. And began writing opposite the lampstand on the plaster on the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the back of the hand that did the writing. Then the king's face grew pale, and his thoughts alarmed him, and his hip joints went slack, and his knees began knocking together. The king called aloud to bring in the conjurers and the Chaldeans and the diviners. The king spoke and said to the wise men of Babylon, "Any man who can read this instruction and explain its interpretation to me will be clothed with purple and have a necklace of gold around his neck and have authority as third ruler in the kingdom." Then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the inscription or make known its interpretation to the king. Then King Belshazzar was greatly alarmed, and his face grew even paler, and his nobles were perplexed. He offers up the third ruler of the kingdom. Probably what we're seeing here is that he's a co-regent, so technically his father is king. He's the co-regent, and so he's offering the next person in authority. You'd be the highest person in authority under the king if you can interpret this. The words are plain. When it says they couldn't read it, perhaps they couldn't read it because of the script it's written in, or perhaps it's not so much they couldn't read it because the words are simple words. It's you could read the words, they just don't make any sense. It'd be as if we gave three words, and you got these three words, but they're not connected to anything. So I give you the three words, I'll say number, way, divide, and you're going, "Well, I can read the words, I have no clue what it means." And so in one sense you say, "I can't read it because it's not a sentence, it doesn't make sense." So it's one of those two. Either the script was such that they couldn't decipher what the actual word was, or it seems more likely to me when it says they're not able to read it, is it's not that they couldn't read the word. The word makes no sense. So you say, "I can't read it because I don't know what it means." And therefore, they could not give even close to an interpretation. And so here the king is even more perplexed now. He offers all this up, but nobody's able to give him an insight, and his hand just appeared out of nowhere and wrote these words on the wall. The whole experience for him is very, started off alarming, but it becomes even more alarming as it goes along, even more so when no one's able to help out with it. Well, often the best time to speak of the good news is during a time when bad news is the dominant news. C.S. Lewis wrote once that pain is God's megaphone to a deaf world. There's a passage in Timothy about praying for for peace and praying for those in authority so there would be peace, so the gospel can go forth. There's something about things being peaceful, a time of peace that allows us the freedom to speak. But at the same time, some of the times that people are open is when they're in pain. Well, that's one of the things we see here. Apparently, either Belshazzar or likely a previous king, since there had been others that had reigned before him, a couple of kings for a short period of time than his father, had forced Daniel into an early retirement. Daniel's off the scene. How long he's been off the scene? Could have been 23 years. Could have been immediately after Nebuchadnezzar died that the next person coming in doesn't have any use for Daniel. Or it could have been as, each of those kings there, he just kind of shrinks away. Or he doesn't shrink away there, but he's just pushed away. Others come into place. But Daniel's off the scene. This king follows, the kings following Nebuchadnezzar had turned to various gods for support. And we see here that this king, Belshazzar, is seeking just the various pagan gods for support. The queen, that is the mother of Belshazzar, possibly the wife of Nebuchadnezzar, but more likely it's the wife of Belshazzar's father, and that Belshazzar is not a direct son of Nebuchadnezzar, but a grandson. But she comes and tells the king of the abilities of Daniel, and how that King Nebuchadnezzar had pointed him over all the wise men. So here you are in a setting where you're saying the wise men come in and they go, "We have no clue. We don't know. We cannot even offer up an opinion on this." And then the queen mother comes in and says, "Hey, there's one. There's one here that he has insight. He has been given abilities by the gods to have insight." And Nebuchadnezzar, when he was king, he elevated him to the top of the wise men because this guy was so insightful. And Nebuchadnezzar recognized his value. And he's here. He's here. So look at these verses with me. Verse 10. The queen entered the banquet hall because of the words of the king and his nobles. The queen spoke and said, "O king, live forever. Do not let your thoughts alarm you or your face be pale. There is a man in your kingdom in whom a spirit of the holy gods, and in the days of your father, illumination, insight, and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father, the king, appointed him chief of the magicians, conjurers, Chaldeans, and diviners. This was because an extraordinary spirit, knowledge, and insight, interpretation of dreams, explanation of enigmas, and solving of difficult problems were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belshazzar. Let Daniel now be summoned, and he will declare the interpretation." Well, Daniel's apparently had been of no value to anyone for some time, put out to pasture. But now comes a situation. These people don't even know of Daniel. They've dismissed him. If they've heard the stories, they just either believe they were myth or that's something a long time ago, and they've just pushed it aside. But the queen mother comes in and says, "There is one." Now, she's possibly Nebuchadnezzar's daughter, a real distinct possibility, not distant possibility that it's his wife, but more likely maybe his daughter. She apparently has a personal memory of this. And she's saying, "There is one." And she speaks in the same terminology that Nebuchadnezzar spoke of Daniel. This is one that has been elevated. This is one that has insight. This is one that has a connection with the holy gods. This is one that can reveal mysteries. Well, the king is in desperate need. Nobody can help him out at this time, and so he obviously is open. So when all else fails, even the disobedient unbelieving are open to the man of God. The unbeliever is not simply one who never believed. And often we fall into that. That's how we speak nowadays. We speak passively of unbelievers. You know, believers are ones that believe. And we speak of non-believers as those that just never believed. It's almost as though there's, you know, mankind is, they are unbelievers. That's just who they are. And some believe. They take an active role of believing. And everybody else just stays where they were. That's kind of how we speak. But there really isn't. It's really not simply one who's never believed, but rather it's one who refused to believe. John 3:18 is much more of a sense of they refuse to believe. It's one who does not know God. In John 17:3, it's Christ says, this is eternal life, to know God and to know His Son. See, it's that active sense of knowing. It's one who has disobeyed the call of the gospel. In 2 Thessalonians, it doesn't speak of unbelievers as those who passively don't believe, but that they are disobedient to the gospel. So this sense of rejecting is not a passive thing. It's an open act. Maybe in one sense it's not so conscious that one says, okay, I'm going to reject God, but there is information that's made available. People become aware of God, and it's either an embracing God or pushing God away. And Belshazzar has pushed God away. The unbelieving have chosen to reject the truth about God that they have been given. In Luke 17:31, it's at the end of a story that Jesus tells about a rich man and Lazarus. And you'll recall where the rich man has everything and Lazarus has nothing, and yet they both, they die. And the rich man is coming back basically, and he's saying, if one from the dead, you know, I'm worried about my brothers. If one from the dead could come, you know, if I could just come back and tell them it, and so they have Moses and the prophets. They don't need somebody to be resurrected to tell them the message. They have the truth. See, you know, we often want to, well, if I could only, well, no, you already have the truth. You don't need more truth. You don't need more dramatic truth. If you don't respond to the truth you have, you're not going to respond to other truth. Belshazzar has had the truth. He's heard the stories of Nebuchadnezzar, and he's rejected them. But now, when all else fails, sometimes people are open. The unbeliever sometimes is open when everything else falls apart. So even though Belshazzar had previously rejected Daniel and Daniel's God, the very God that his father had personally experienced, or the very God that, you know, maybe his grandfather had experienced, he now is desperate and open to hear the truth. You know, the man of God carries the insights of God. You know, in the passage we talk about primarily for inspiration in 2 Timothy 3:16, the Word of God is inspired, or the Word of God, you know, is breathed out by God. But it goes through that describing it and says that the man of God might be adequate. You know, that Daniel carries the insights of God, and now he has an opportunity to speak. And verses 13 to 16, then Daniel was brought in before the king. Daniel was brought in before the king. The king spoke and said to Daniel, "Are you the Daniel who is one of the exiles from Judah, whom my father the king brought from Judah? Now I've heard about you that the spirit of the gods is in you, and that illumination, insight, and extraordinary wisdom have been found in you. Just now the wise men and the conjurers were brought in before me that they might read this inscription and make its interpretation known to me. But they could not declare the interpretation of the message. But I personally have heard about you, that you are able to give interpretations and solve difficult problems. Now, if you are able to read the inscription and make its interpretation known to me, you will be clothed with purple and wear a necklace of gold around your neck, and you will have authority as the third ruler in the kingdom." Well, what an opportunity. I mean, you know, you think about this from a human perspective. I mean, Daniel was very high in Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom. He had enormous power. And he had been put out to pasture. And now somebody needs him. You know, we all long to be valued that way. And to have been rejected and forced into retirement, now somebody comes and says, hey, I hear you have what we need. I mean, what an opportunity for Daniel. Now, we're going to make you the top again. You'll be the third person. Nobody's over you except the king. You have everything you want, Daniel. All you have to do is interpret this. But that's not really where he's at. You know, those who embrace spirituality while rejecting the Most High God are arrogant, as they pursue gods that they ultimately control. Thus, the spirituality is self-promoting. You embrace a spirituality. You know, I'm spiritual, but yet my spirituality rejects the Most High God. I pursue gods that I ultimately control. Thus, spirituality is just self-promoting. See, that's so much of the spirituality that we read about today. When you hear about people that are spiritual, they're into spirituality. You know, I hear you're back in the church and you're in this, you're in that. Well, yeah, but... And then they start talking about God, but it's not the God of the historic faith. It's some redefined God because I'm in control. See, it's... You know, it's all about control with pagan gods. So here's Belshazzar, we're going to drink all these drinks, and we're going to drink out of gold and silver goblets to the gods of gold and silver. We're going to drink to these gods so that they influence things because we control them. How different it is with the Most High God. Well, Daniel contrasts the humility that Nebuchadnezzar had learned from the Most High God and the lack of humility that Belshazzar has demonstrated. Daniel will also confront Belshazzar with the fact that he had rejected the testimony of his own grandfather, perhaps, whatever the relationship there was, and turned a deaf ear to the Most High God. Look at these verses in 17 to 24. Then Daniel answered and said before the king, "Keep your gifts for yourself, or give your rewards to someone else. However, I will read the inscription to the king and make the interpretation known to him. O king, the Most High God granted sovereignty, grandeur, glory, and majesty to Nebuchadnezzar, your father." Look who gave Nebuchadnezzar power. The Most High God. Daniel starts off, there is a God. There is a Most High God. And Nebuchadnezzar had power. This kingdom exists because of the Most High God. Because of the grandeur which he had bestowed on him, all the peoples, nations, and men of every language feared and trembled before him. Whomever he wished he killed, and whomever he wished to spare alive, he spared alive, and whomever he wished he elevated, and whomever he wished he humbled. There is a way of saying you're sovereign in a human, you know, on a human realm. When you have great power, if you want someone dead, they're dead. If you want someone to live, they live. If you want someone to be elevated to the highest position, they're elevated. If you want someone to be humbled, they're humbled. That was Nebuchadnezzar. But why was he in that position? Because the great God of heaven made him so. But when his hot heart was lifted up and his spirit became so proud that he behaved arrogantly, he was disposed from his royal throne and his glory was taken away from him. Yeah, okay, here was this great king. He had everything. Hey, but it was all taken away from him. He was also driven away from mankind and his heart was made like that of beasts. And his dwelling place was the wild donkeys. He was given grass to eat like cattle and his body was drenched with the dew of heaven until he recognized that the Most High God is ruler over the realm of mankind and that he sets over it whomever he wishes. That was Nebuchadnezzar. You've heard these stories. What did you do with this story? You've heard of this. but you've just written it off as myth now. Oh, that was 20 years ago. That was 30 years ago. That was 40 years ago. Whatever the time period was, I wasn't alive when that happened. Or I was a little kid. It doesn't really matter anymore. Yeah, it happened once. I'm not sure I even believe those stories. Whatever it was, he says, you've heard it. You knew of it. Yet you, his son, and that's probably not a direct descendant, I like, you know, a father's son, but more of speaking of your son in the sense of this is one that came before you, and probably his grandfather. Yet you, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, even though you knew all this. You've heard this. You were aware of this. But you dismissed it. You know, we have a hard time learning from others. You know, but we cannot always depend upon personal experience. We have to draw from those that have gone before us. We have to be able to look at the stories of the Bible and say, this is truth, and we're responsible for it, and we're going to respond to it. He didn't. But Daniel's here, and Daniel says, I can interpret it, but I want nothing to do with it. I don't want your gold. I don't want your position. And perhaps if Daniel's already read the inscription and knows the interpretation, he would also know it's only going to last for a night anyway. But I think if Daniel knew the interpretation was that Babylon was going to reign for another 100 years, his response would still be the same. I'm not here for what you can offer. Because Daniel is a servant of the Most High God. Well, sometimes the message from God is not a pleasant message. But it's always true. Sometimes it's not a pleasant message. Sometimes it's not the message of deliverance. Sometimes it's the message of doom. But it's always true. The words were simple to read, but the message was difficult to interpret. Mina is used twice. It's a word play meaning number. Tekel means to weigh or to be weighed out and found light, that is to be lacking. Paris is broken or divided. The interpretation, you know, is the kingdom of Belshazzar has been numbered. That is, it is coming to an end, and there's a double emphasis here. It's just going to be a sudden end. The kingdom has been judged on a balance beam, and it's, you know, the balance beam is it's light. It's lacking. It's in debt. The kingdom is broken and is going to be divided, and the two parts will be given to the Medes and the Persians. Now this is the inscription that was written out, Mina Mina Tekel Upshon. This is the interpretation of the message. God has numbered your kingdom and put an end to it. That's pretty blunt. It's been numbered. So see if you see the word number. I mean, you might be able to read the word number, but it doesn't make any sense. But Daniel puts it straight. It's been numbered. You've been numbered. Your kingdom is numbered. The days have been calculated. It's been reckoned. We've numbered it out. Oh, by the way, it's over. You're at the end. You've been weighed on the scales and found deficient. It's lacking. It's a balance beam. You're light. You don't hold balance. You're in debt. Your kingdom has been divided and given over to the Medes and the Persians. Well, Belshazzar fulfills his promise to honor David, or Daniel, even though Daniel had requested that no such honor be bestowed upon him. Verse 29, he gave orders and clothed Daniel in purple and put a necklace of gold around his neck and issued a proclamation concerning him that he was now had the authority as the third ruler in the kingdom. However, the fulfillment of the handwriting on the wall took place that very night as King Darius conquered Babylon and Belshazzar was killed. That same night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was slain. So Darius the Mede received the kingdom at about the age of 62. Babylon, the first nation that would rule over Israel since the inception of Israel. God called Abraham to be the father of a nation. You have sons, the patriarchs born, finally through Joseph, they end up in Egypt. they're in a great position, but yet over time seems to become a threat by their growing numbers. They're made slaves. Moses leads them out. They were a people. They're let out, and they're going to their land and thus become a nation. And the nation Israel moves in and conquers the land. Go through a period of judges, go through a period of, where as they grow and they expand and they want a king, and we come into the period of the kings, though that was never God's plan for them. That wasn't the ideal plan. God should have always been their king, but they wanted king. They wanted to be like the other nations. And so you have Saul and David and Solomon, and then the kingdom splits. The northern kingdom lasts for a period of time, and then they are defeated, and the southern king lasts longer. But there's this continual rejection of God, and so now a time of discipline comes. But there has been the nation of Israel, and it's been God's kingdom. But now they're under this period of judgment, and a Gentile nation rules over them. Babylon was that first Gentile nation. Nebuchadnezzar was that first Gentile king. And God got in touch with Nebuchadnezzar. God got his attention. And Nebuchadnezzar recognized that the God of Israel is the supreme God. He is the most high God. But Nebuchadnezzar dies. And those that follow, there's a, if not an immediate dropping off, there is at least a dropping off where there's no recognition of the God of Daniel anymore. And now judgment comes. And it follows the pattern that God had told Nebuchadnezzar it would, that his throne, his kingdom would be supreme, and after him would come another one, and it would be less. But the sad thing here in the judgment, even though it's going to follow this, the judgment comes because of a failure to recognize, a failure to believe, a failure to embrace the testimony that Nebuchadnezzar had written. And the whole kingdom seems to have forgotten except for this one lady. The queen mother says, remember what happened. Remember there's Daniel. Remember his position. Remember what Nebuchadnezzar said. But everybody else is like, that's an old man. What does he have to offer? What he has to offer is a relationship with the Most High God. But now it was too late. And judgment came. Judgment came that night. History tells us that while Babylon was an incredibly secure place and had stored up food, they could lasted, you know, their view of they can outlast this attack. There was a river that running through the city, and the Persians and the Medes and the Persians, they stopped up the river, dammed up the river, creating an alleyway into the city, came into the city during this great feast, and conquered the city that night. Handwriting on the wall, the time is numbered. It's numbered. It's immediate. Judgment will come. You're lacking, and the kingdom will be given away. Daniel had given great promises to Nebuchadnezzar in the first dream. You have a great kingdom, but that kingdom won't last forever. But it will last through Nebuchadnezzar. And now we see the movement into the next stage. And the great thing that we'll see as we move on is that it's the same God, Yahweh, that's going to influence the next king that's over Israel. So as the Mede and the Persians kings come in, now God says, I got to get your attention because you're the king over my nation. And let's be clear about this. I'm God and that's my nation. But unfortunately, for Belshazzar, he didn't embrace the truth he was offered. And the truth was there. And it's pointed out in this chapter. You knew it. You heard the stories. Perhaps he personally had heard the stories. But personally from Nebuchadnezzar even. But he knew of it. He rejected it. And that's what unbelief is. It's a rejecting of truth. But Daniel's always faithful. We don't know a lot about Daniel. I mean, we feel like we know so much, and then we realize wait a minute, this happened when he was, 16. This happened when he was probably 20. This happened when he was, maybe 30. Now he's 80. Daniel's, was his life always easy? What was it like being forced in retirement? What was it like for Daniel to be, at the top of the kingdom and now to be not even invited in to offer an opinion? But when he came, he was ready. And he wasn't seeking his own glory. He was the man of God. Will you stand with me as we close in prayer? Father, we thank you so much for your gifts. We thank you so much for the gift of revelation, for your word. For there's no way we would know of this without your revelation. Father, help us to have insight into your word, to be able to understand. And Father, help us most of all to respond to it. Father, we might not be arrogant, seeking ourselves, but that we might be humble, bowing before you. And that we might always be responsive to your word and your truth. And we do pray in Christ's name. Amen.